God rules and overrules in the affairs of persons and peoples. Welcome, everyone. I'm McDaniel Phillips, and this is Times of Refreshing, a ministry of Bethesda Hall in partnership with TWR Asia. Our host is author, teacher, and itinerant speaker, Kenneth Wong. Well, yesterday in part four of The Sovereign Hand of God, Ken told us of Mordecai's unexpected exaltation and Haman's execution. Things happened quickly once God's time and hour arrived. In a mere 24 hours, we witnessed a remarkable reversal of fortunes, of tragedy being turned to triumph as the tables were turned. Well, in just a moment, we learn what happens when God's overruling and overturning reaches a peak with part five of The Sovereign Hand of God.
Hello, everyone. I'm sure you have all been looking forward to this fifth and final part in the study of the book of Esther entitled The Sovereign Hand. We stopped at a point of suspense yesterday, not having quite finished the abolition of Haman and the abrupt end at the second feast of Esther. When the king asked Esther for a third time, it really makes you wonder who was really in greater suspense over the petition, the king or the queen? The one who is supposed to grant the request, or the one who is making the request. All this can only be so because it is the Lord's doing and it's marvelous in our eyes. Here then, at long last, was Esther's real petition. In chapter 7, verse 3 of the book of Esther, "Then Queen Esther answered and said, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss.'" Verse 5. "So King Ahasuerus," or King Xerxes, "answered and said to Queen Esther, 'Who is he and where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?' And Esther said, 'The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman.' So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. In the fullness of God's perfect time, the petition was finally presented, together with the revelation of the wicked one who was behind the plot and the decree to exterminate her people. The king needed no further questions or reasons. He simply took Esther at her word. Esther's word of grace and truth prevailed over Haman's lies. And so it will always be with God's word over Satan's lies. Reading on in verse 7, "Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king." What a complete turnaround to see the wicked Haman pleading for his own life at the hands of the one whose people he had issued the decree to destroy. The king was so hot with anger that he had to go out into the palace garden to calm himself and to cool down a little bit. In verse 8, "When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, 'Will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house?' As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face." Instead of being cooled down, the king was further enraged by the compromising position that Haman had put himself in before the queen. And here comes the final nail in the coffin. Verse 9. "Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, 'Look, the gallows 50 cubits high which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman.' Then the king said, 'Hang him on it.' So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided." It was a wonder he didn't die of a heart attack. I would venture to think that he turned beetroot red with rage, not only because of the atrocity of his plot, which has now been laid bare by Esther, but also because he was embarrassed and angry with himself for being deceived by Haman and used as a pawn for his wicked plans. And that can only find respite by bringing his own blood upon his own head. And what more perfect and ready way to do that than what his servant simply suggested to him. Look, there are the gallows that Haman himself has prepared for Mordecai, whom the king had just honored and promoted. And that seemed to add salt to the wound. Now it really looks to the king at this point that everything that Haman did or stood for seems to be against the king himself. What a timely suggestion from one of his servants. So we find Haman hanged immediately on the same gallows that he had erected for Mordecai. He was destroyed by his own devices. The gallows that Haman erected for Mordecai, his archenemy, was a vivid symbol of the principle of retribution. Beware of the root of bitterness springing up, which can cancel all happiness. Haman should have been satisfied, but he was not. Instead, he let the root of bitterness spring up to neutralize all his happiness. He never even had the chance to bring up his grand plan of hanging Mordecai on his gallows to the king. And now the final piece of jigsaw has been put into place. The fateful move had been made, and now it was checkmate. The psalmist wrote of this in Psalm 9, verses 15 and 16. The nations have sunk down in the pit which they have made. In the net which they hid, their own foot is caught. The Lord is known by the judgment he executes. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands. So what we have seen is God's retribution played out to full perfection. Haman's execution followed swiftly on the heels of Mordecai's exaltation. This was a day of reckoning for Haman and his wickedness. Just as Vashti, the previous queen, was replaced by Esther for her insubordination, so Haman was replaced by Mordecai for his wickedness. The enemy now had been eliminated and put out of the way. But although the personal score had been settled by a righteous God, there remains the fallout and ramifications of his evil plot, which still remained to be put right. And we see that happening in the next chapter 8. Chapter 8 begins with verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, "If it pleases the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen?" This next episode is about the annulling of the first decree that Haman had made for the destruction of the Jews. To annul is to invalidate, to repeal or to revoke. And this was the second time that the golden scepter had been extended to Esther, because she had come unbidden before the king, and it was also her fourth request. This was not a case of increasingly taking the king for granted, but rather we can always keep coming boldly before God's throne of grace for help in time of need. Now that the source of the evil had been removed in Haman, the effects or the consequences of his evil intent now needed to be neutralized. Once again, the king heeded Esther's words and granted her petition above all they could ask for or imagine. In verse 8 of chapter 8, "You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews, as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke." The first decree, which was also issued in the king's name, could not technically be revoked, but it could effectively be invalidated or nullified or annulled simply by introducing a second decree through Mordecai, which would in effect supersede the first. And this is done by accomplishing the opposite. Instead of being exterminated, they were now empowered to exterminate their enemies in turn. God's overruling and overturning is now reaching its peak. We find God's intervention moving from the personal sphere to the national spheres. Verse 9 of chapter 8. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded, to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces, from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred from swift steeds. By these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. On one day, in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. So we see that barely 2 months after the first decree was issued on the 13th of the first month by Haman, Mordecai now issued the second decree, which was sent out on the 23rd day of the third month, to overturn and to reverse it. How drastically the tide had turned within a space of 2 agonizing and perplexing months. Verse 15, so Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them. This great rejoicing over the news that came from the second decree was a great contrast with the perplexity that befell everyone after the first decree was issued. Many began to turn to their true God, who was glorified. There was great fear and respect for them and their God, and this turned out to be a bright and powerful testimony for them before the nations. As the psalmist said in Psalm 96 verse 10, say among the nations, the Lord reigns. So that was the annulling of the decree recorded in chapter 8. In chapter 9, we have the annihilating of the enemies as it actually transpired when the day finally came. This is the greatest irony of all. The irony of ironies is that on the exact day that the original lot that Haman had cast for Purim, which fell on the 13th day of the 12th month, which was to have been the fateful day on which the destruction of the Jews was to have been carried out according to the first decree, is now the exact same day on which the second decree now empowers the Jews to protect themselves by killing their enemies. This turnaround or contrast is brought out in the very first verse of chapter 9. Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. Verse 2, the Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all people. And we find the fear of God falling upon all the officials of the provinces, including the governors and those who did the king's work, so much so that they helped them instead of opposed them. Verse 4, for Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man Mordecai became increasingly prominent. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. When at last the day of reckoning came, on the 13th day of the 12th month, this was what actually transpired as recorded in chapter 9 of Esther. In the capital of Shushan, where the citadel was, 500 of their enemies and the 10 sons of Haman were killed on the 13th day, with another 75,000 of their enemies in all the other provinces. After a further petition by Esther to the king for an extension of another day in the capital, another 300 were killed in Shushan on the 14th day, while that was a day of rest and rejoicing in the other provinces. So those in the city of Shushan celebrated, rejoiced, and rested on the 15th day. What was noteworthy was that they did not lay their hands on the plunder, even though the decree had actually permitted them to, as we have read in chapter 8, verse 11. They are together on that day to protect their lives, to annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, and to plunder their possessions. But as it turned out in chapter 9, this is what we read. For example, in verse 10, they killed their enemies, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. And it's the same in verses 15 and 16, where it was reiterated, they did not lay a hand on the plunder. What they did was not for their own greed or gain, but for God's glory. The Feast of Purim was made into an annual commemoration of a day to remember. Chapter 9, verse 20, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews near and far, who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. And typically, the observance would begin with day one on the 14th day of the 12th month with fasting and with reading of the book of Esther. And on day two, on the 15th day, it would be a day of feasting and rejoicing. So it's fasting and reading on the first day and feasting and rejoicing on the second day. And we too can have our personal Purims to remember God's deliverance, His preservation, and His mercies. And for Christians and the church, the greatest remembrance for us is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And this remembrance feast is done regularly in the breaking of bread. So Purim, in a way, foreshadows a greater day of turning from death to life and sorrow to joy, which is at Easter. For then it was the day when sorrow was turned to joy. And these were the same words that Jesus used to comfort and to encourage His disciples before He left the world. In John's Gospel, chapter 16, verse 20, He said, "But your sorrow will be turned into joy." And in Luke chapter 21, verse 13, He said, "But it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony." And you can definitely write that against what happened to Esther and Mordecai and their people then. God rules and overrules in the affairs of persons and peoples. The principle of Purim is that things do not happen by lot, which is the meaning of pur. They don't happen by chance, but by the sovereign hand of God. The basis of life is not existential nor circumstantial, but providential, as we have noted in the very opening of this series. It's a reminder in the face of adversity, atrocity, and absurdity that God still reigns on the throne, even when He seems to be nowhere in sight for the time being. And as we intercede, He intervenes. Often our great mistake is intervention without intercession. I've called this last part the anticipation of God, because although God's hand is over all sovereignly from beginning through to end, it may be unseen or invisible or hidden at times. But in God, we can always anticipate a happy and a sure end. Chapter 9, verse 30 says, "Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth." There can be no true and lasting peace without the truth. And the closing scene in chapter 10, which only has three verses, is one of advancing the peace which comes from God. The closing verse 3 says, "For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people, and speaking peace to all his countrymen." Real peace and prosperity can only come from ruling in the fear of God, with God overseeing all things through his servants. God has never left himself without witness. Whenever his people have been under the rule of heathen empires, as evidenced by the great biblical statesmen in the Bible who were virtually the right-hand men of the world empires in their generation. We have Joseph in the Egyptian Empire, Daniel in the Babylonian Empire, and here Mordecai in the Persian Empire. We can truly say that Romans 8:28 has been perfectly demonstrated throughout the book of Esther, and it's a fitting verse to summarize aptly the whole book. "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose." And I trust, having seen the sovereign hand of God, you have been refreshed by his presence and reached by his word.
Do you commemorate a personal Purim to remember God's deliverance, preservation, and mercies in your personal history with God? Thank you for that good word, Kenneth. This is Times of Refreshing, a ministry of Bethesda Hall in partnership with TWR Asia. And I invite you to join us again next time when Kenneth returns with another reflection from God's Word. Right now, though, we would love to hear from you, and I have several ways through which you can be in contact. You can send us a text message at 9431-3813, or you can write to us at Post Office Box 392, Thompson Road Post Office, Singapore 915-714. You can go to our Facebook page and leave your comments there or share some views with some of the other folks you see. Also, I invite you to visit our website, www.timesofrefreshing.asia, where you can listen to the program right online. And Times of Refreshing has launched an iPhone app that allows users to directly access the broadcast messages and the podcasts right from their iPhones. I'm McDaniel Phillips, inviting you to join us again for Times of Refreshing.